Tonight on Arena, we look at representations of the figure of Jesus in literature and film, and T.S. Eliot Prize-winning poet Sinead Morrissey on her selected poems. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. And to start this evening, boarding school dramas have always had a certain allure for the young reader. All that pent-up youthful enthusiasm and nervousness encased within the school walls. Well, the great children's writer Enid Blyton had a soft spot for boarding schools and wrote a number of series in that setting. The best known of them, Mallory Towers, has just been made into a 13-part drama for CBBC. And one of the writers is Richie Conroy, who's with me on the line this evening. I suppose Enid Blyton, St. Clair's and Mallory Towers. Mallory Towers, probably the best known central character of Daryl Rivers and her friends and her arch rival, Gwendolyn Mary, to give her full title. How well versed were you, Richie, in the Mallory Towers story before you joined the writing room for this?
I wasn't aware of Mallory Towers. I'd read The Famous Five and The Secret Seven. And my sister, Sarah, had actually read all the Mallory Towers stories. So she was delighted when I got the job and she was able to give me her old copies and I was able to brush up. But the first series is set around the first book, so it's Daryl Rivers' arrival at Mallory Towers and her, you know, her settling into life in the boarding school and making, you know, her quest to make friends and so
fit in, really. But yeah, let's go back to your sister's copies of Mallory Towers. So you actually had her original copies when you read them then, with your 2020 hat on. How old-fashioned were they? Were you surprised in any way by them?
I mean, they were old-fashioned. The dialogue and stuff was of its time. However, the characters were very recognisable and their hopes and dreams are exactly the same as the hopes and dreams of children in today's world, which is to find their place in the world, make friends, understand the world that they live in. And it was quite easy to connect with them all, really. Especially Daryl. That journey of going to a strange place and feeling like an alien in a landscape is something that I think we can all connect to when we think back to our teenage years.
But the books are set, certainly the early parts of the book, set in the immediate post-war period in Britain. Is it very much, you know, stuck in that or set in that period? I know it is in terms of the look of the production, but I'm just wondering about some of the attitudes within the production. Did you have to update Enid Blyton in any way?
Well, there were a couple of passages in the book that were difficult to translate to a modern day audience. The girls, if you read the original stories, the girls are actually quite hard to each other. Quite harsh, and even the main character Daryl she's a bit of a temper, and she in one famous moment in the story in the first book she actually slaps one of the main characters, so it was a bit of a challenge to retain these moments in the story, but actually to not lose the main character while telling that story, because I mean it's hard to follow a main character if we think that she's doing stuff that's pretty nasty. So it was important that we looked into Daryl's backstory as well and maybe looked at the reasons why she might have had issues with her temper. And that actually opened up a whole new strand of a story for us that we tell throughout the episodes in the series.
I love the fact that you use the word horrid when describing the character of Daryl. Yeah. Certainly, that's a very Enid Blyton word. I didn't notice when I watched the first episode. I didn't notice that much of the Enid Blyton style of, you know, jolly hockey sticks in some ways, particularly in the attitudes of, and maybe this is because of my lack of knowledge of Mallory Towers, it must be admitted. The attitudes of the principal in the school, Miss Grayling. Let's listen to a clip, actually, which features Ella Bright plays the character of Daryl Rivers, and Gwendolyn Mary Lacey is played by a young actress called Danya Griver, or Griver, I'm not sure how we say her name. But they arrive into the principal's office thinking that they're in major trouble. But Jennifer Wigmore, who plays Miss Grayling, perhaps gives them a little surprise in this clip.
It's not fair. I didn't do anything. It was all her.
You're not here because you're in trouble. I see all the new girls on their first night.
You do?
It's one of my favourite moments. Seeing you all the day you join us. Imagining what you might achieve. What would you like that to be?
Passing our school certificate?
Exams aren't our only measure of success. A Mallory Towers success is someone good-hearted and kind, loyal and trustworthy. Good, sound women the world can lean on. Women unafraid to forge a new future. You will all gain tremendously from your time with us. See that you give a lot back.
That's exactly what my father said.
Well, perhaps one day he and Mallory Towers will be equally proud of you.
There we go. Jennifer Wigmore as Miss Grayling in a clip there from the new CBBC version of the Enid Blyton story. And Richie Conroy, one of the writers of the series, is talking with me this evening. That kind of thing kind of surprised me a little bit. You know, the forward-thinking nature, particularly of Miss Grayling and this institution that we might have expected to be a little bit stuck in the mud. Was that within the Enid Blyton books, Richie, or was this something that was invented or maybe magnified in the writer's room?
No, that was very much part of the original text by Enid Blyton. Her text celebrated boarding school and empowered, you know, she wrote it apparently as a kind of, her daughters were heading off to boarding school, and it just gave her the idea to write this book. And what the clip we just heard there, Miss Grayling kind of sets out the quest for the series, if you like. That's what Daryl has to kind of go and do, is becoming, like, you know, it's not about passing exams or anything like that. It's really about making friends and making a difference and making your mark in the world. And even though the book was written in 1946, that was the attitude in the book. And it was very much about empowering younger readers, especially girls, that they can do whatever they like. You know, we're talking about post-war Britain, where traditionally, like, women would be expected to get married and have children and not be thinking about a career. And obviously Enid Blyton was a celebrated author, a prolific author, so she wanted to, you know, imbue her works with this attitude as well. Yeah. Of like, no, we can step up. We don't, Daryl wants to be a doctor, and there's a passage in the book where Gwendolyn wonders whether girls can even become doctors. Surely she means a nurse, you know?
Yeah.
And that sort of sums up what Blyton was trying to achieve as well, was that, like, girls can reach for the stars too, and that should be something that they should try for.
Yeah, and I keep mentioning the writer's room here, and I'm just wondering, is the writer's room just that? It's often used, I think, as a figurative term, but this was a co-production with BBC Canada. There was a writer's room, and a lot of you were in there. Tell us the sort of atmosphere that was in that room in the writing process.
Yeah, so we met on two different occasions, and we broke every episode. Well, apart from the pilot episode, which was written, so we had 12 episodes to break. And what that actually means is literally 12 people sitting around the table, including the executives from the BBC and from the Family Channel in Canada, who rarely would be in that room. So it was a real privilege, actually, to get to spend some time with the commissioners and get their point of view on the stories and on the characters and how they were developing. And it also meant that we kind of were not quite pre-approved, but they were able to nix anything. They were able to stop us going down the wrong path. At that point, we were kind of thinking of a sort of slightly supernatural story that was a lot bigger. It's still there, but it's a smaller story in the series now. And what you get to actually do in the writer's room is you get to kind of see each episode in a sort of embryonic stage, and you may not be writing episode two, but you know what's happening in episode two. So you know not to, you know where, if you're doing episode three, you know where to steer clear because that's being covered in episode two. And you understand the overall arc of the series as well, that like there are certain beats that are important to, and I'm getting quite deep in the weeds here of writing, so yeah. Please stop me if I'm boring.
No,
but,
go ahead.
Just the different beats, because like if when you're planning a 13 episode series, you want there to be peaks and troughs and, you know, things to be going well for the main character and then things to really look bleak.
Yes.
And so we basically have a blueprint then after a week of what the entire series looks like, and then we go off and kind of storyline and then eventually go into scripting. Obviously things can change, and it's a go on, yeah.
Yeah, no, I guess that, you know, that those beats and these peaks and troughs that you're talking about there, those are the same type of rules that you would experience in any writing room for any television series. And working in, with a group of writers with a big blueprint for a 12 or 13 episode series, that those skills are immediately transferable to all sorts of different television dramas for whatever age group.
Absolutely. And I mean, it's something that's employed in, you know, I work a bit in Fair City, and it's something that is employed there. It's very much the American model. And it's something that European productions are trying to bring more of is the notion of the showrunner, the writer, not just being somebody who writes a script and then sort of goes away, but somebody who's very much in part of the process from script to screen. Because they've identified the big shows in America, and they've realized that the common denominator is that there's a consistent voice from script to screen, and that's what makes all these memorable series like, you know, Sopranos or The Wire or Deadwood or any of these ones so good and so unique. So they're trying to bring that into Europe, and the soap operas already do it, but it's becoming more. That was my first experiences of it in a drama, and it worked really well, I have to say.
I want to take a little scene from, I think this is one of the episodes that you wrote, in fact, featuring the French teacher. Now, Daryl has well established herself as kind of the class joker and the great, you know, that tomboy attitude that she has, to use that phrase that I don't particularly like, tomboy. But anyway, Ella Bright playing the character of Daryl Rivers here. And she's pretending that she has a little problem with her ears, which of course leads to lots of fun making laughs at the French teacher.
Now open your books to chapter 4. Daryl Rivers, what are you doing?
You said to throw our books on the floor.
I most certainly did not.
Daryl's been given drops for an ear infection, mademoiselle, so you'll have to speak up.
Daryl, is this true? Daryl! Daryl! If I speak this loud, can you hear?
No, I'm not allowed to drink beer.
Not beer. Hear. Oh, silence maintenant. Girls, you forget yourselves. This is quite enough of this giddiness. Jean? You think this is funny? Silence! Marie-Lou, please!
Harry Blue Cheese?
Silence, maintenant, silence!
What's happening in here? Is there a reason for all this noise?
I'm sorry, Miss Potts. The girls are quite giddy this morning.
And there we go. That's Genevieve Baudet playing the French teacher in Mallory Towers. And yes, we certainly heard Ella Bright and some of the other young girls in Mallory Towers in the midst of that clip, Richie Conroy. That is one of the, you wrote that scene in that particular episode. You were part of that very much so, Richie?
Oh, very much so. Yeah, I co-wrote that with Mark Hodkinson. I can't take all the credit. But, you know, it does, you know, we sort of dipped into our own experiences as well in school, because that was the sort of, you know, we weren't particularly innocent children as well, and we would often like enjoy pranking the teacher, you know. So these girls aren't just prim and proper. There's a bit of an edge to them, and that's the fun. And the interesting thing about the series as well is that the teachers are very much peripheral. They don't kind of helicopter in and solve the girls' problems. The girls are very much empowered to figure out their own world and solve any problems and issues they have with themselves. So we're very conscious of keeping the adult characters just in the background.
Yeah, the other thing that struck me, the character that we hear there, the Genevieve Bode character, obviously it's a little bit of, ABC, or the Acme School of French. it is a bit of a racial stereotype there. But what was very striking in the casting of the girls was the diversity of ethnicity that is certainly visible on screen. Did that begin to play into any of the scripts in a way that I don't think it would have been there? Enid Blyton's books would have been, white English children. I don't think there would have been many children from any other backgrounds kind of referred to within the books.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, we didn't really... We had an aspirational cast when we were writing it, but nobody had been cast yet. But I suppose when we were thinking about the old Commonwealth and the fact that there would be girls from Canada, possibly India, different places that could be coming and going to school in England. I think Gandhi did his schooling in Oxford at one stage, and Mother Teresa was in Dalkey at one stage, So... There is a precedent for different ethnicities to come in, and it didn't really affect the writing.
But can I check with you?
It's very important that it.
You keep an eye on what happened to the Irish character, the matron played by Ashley Maguire.
Yeah, well, she was already. It was already decided that she'd be Irish, and a bit of a cliche Irish woman from the period. But we had a lot of fun writing her. She actually wasn't. That was probably the biggest character that was a departure from the book. But we felt we all felt we needed a good antagonist that could brush up against the girls from time to time.
Yeah.
Because Miss Grayling and Miss Potts were very, very nice and wouldn't be the types to lose their temper. So it was fun to have Ashley. She did a brilliant job.
Okay, well, listen, thanks for speaking to us about it. Thanks, Richie. Thanks for speaking to us about it all this evening. Not at all. We just a little bit of a delay on the line causing us to trip over one another a few times there. Richie Conroy speaking to us about the upcoming CBBC version of Mallory Towers. And it looks great. It looks like a great period drama. I didn't ask Richie too much about that, but it has all the period detail in there, I must say, on the basis of the episode I saw. Now, you might remember a couple of weeks ago, we spoke to soprano Claudia Boyle about the Metropolitan Opera House in New York and their decision to make available some of their best filmed operas from the last 20 years. Well, the world's premier jazz festival is following suit, it would seem. Over the weekend, the Montreux Jazz Festival announced it was going to share 56 concerts from its archive. The festival is entering its 54th year and is held in the town of Montreux on Lake Montreux in Lake Geneva, on the shorelines of that lake in Switzerland. Now, it's been a bone of contention with some critics that jazz festivals around the world have strayed somewhat from strictly featuring jazz artists. And if you look at the archive in that Montreux Jazz Festival, you'll see artists like Phil Collins, Wu-Tang Clan and Carlos Santana, amongst many others. But there quite definitely is some incredible jazz and soul to be heard and seen as well, including the likes of Quincy Jones, Etta James and Ray Charles. There's also a fantastic 1976 concert from legendary jazz singer and pianist Nina Simone. So let's have a flavour of that concert. This is her iconic tune, I Wish I Knew What It Were To Be Free.
Then I'd sing, 'cause I know how it feels to be free.
And off she goes, Nina Simone there with a little bit of her performance of I Wish I Knew What It Were To Be Free, performed live at the Montreux Jazz Festival in 1976. That full concert is available to view for free on the festival website, along with 55 other concerts from the festival's 54-year history. And you may know, if you were planning to travel to Switzerland for this year's festival, it is still scheduled to take place between July the 3rd and 18th later this year, although it seems they're holding off on announcing any artists at this point. But the concerts available to view for free until April the 30th of this year on montrojazzfestival.com. Now, there's a feeling of Good Friday about every day at the moment, but this Friday actually is Good Friday, this coming Friday. And so for the week that's in it, we've decided to consider the influence, literal and otherwise, of the figure of Christ on literature and film. And joining me now is Jarlath Killeen, Head of Trinity School of English. We're going to be looking, I suppose, in broad terms, Jarlath, at two different types of representations here. Stories that have a Christ-like figure at the centre, and then stories that tell the Christ story itself, or Christ himself being the focus. And let's start with one of those before we get to the Christ-like figures. The lives of Jesus is a type of a genre. Is this an invention of yours, or is it actually referred to as a lives of Jesus genre, Jarlath?
Yes, that's the way it's talked about. It's really a development of the Victorians or the 19th century, after a sort of sustained period when there was a sort of revolution in theology and in biblical studies, where the Bible began to be looked at less as a sort of a scripture and more as a text, being examined for its sources, its how was it written, how was it put together, rather than by being simply read as a holy text, as a scripture.
And we're talking about a huge number of texts here.
Oh, we are. When people began writing Lives of Jesus, by the end of the 19th century, we're talking about, I suppose, something like 65,000 popular biographies, I suppose. Not just popular, there's all sorts. You get scholarly attempts to write the life of Jesus. You get very, very popular attempts. And one thing that strikes you when you read a lot of them is they're approaching Jesus in a sense as a character, as well as a historical figure. And they're using, the writers are using the techniques of fiction as well as the techniques of a biographer.
Hardly surprising that we would get an actual writer of fiction taking on this particular genre, the Lives of Jesus genre. George Eliot, notable contributor and a translation of a controversial German text, Das Leben Jesu.
Yes, so that's probably the book that really started the Lives of Jesus genre off. Extraordinarily complicated, difficult work by a German liberal theologian, got him into huge amounts of trouble. It essentially tries to demythologize the life of Jesus, talk about him as a human figure which has all these mythological and supernatural accretions that had gathered around him, and approach him as a human figure. Eliot is probably the most famous atheist, English atheist of the period, is very interested in Jesus, sees Jesus as a teacher, but sees him very much as a secular figure and wants to communicate the ideas of Strauss to a wider audience. So she tries this first, obviously, by translating the life of Jesus by Strauss into English. Not many people are going to read very, very complicated works of German theology, even when they're translated into English. So she begins to draw on the life of Jesus in her novels, probably most famously in Silas Marner, a novel that some of us had the pleasure of writing about for our Leaving Certs. Certainly it was a Leaving Cert text for many generations.
Yeah. And what specifically from the German text, what kind of aspects of the life of Jesus as given in that Strauss text do we see transferred then into Silas Marner as a kind of Christ-like figure?
Well, we have a humble man who has a kind of, he's a healer. That's the first thing. So instead of being a supernatural healer, what Eliot does is show this figure as someone who understands nature, who can find the healing properties of nature. But when he uses his abilities in this way, he's considered a supernatural a person who's inspired by God in the first instance and possibly by the devil. So even despite the fact that he's using natural means of healing, he's interpreted by those who surround him as a supernatural figure. And this is very much what Strauss was saying in the life of Jesus, the saying that, you know, that the disciples misinterpreted much of what occurred in the actual life of the historical Jesus. So this is something that Eliot is taking. And so Silas is this humble person who has an ability to heal and help people, who is crucified in the sense that he is found guilty of a crime he doesn't commit. He's exiled from his community. He feels forsaken by God. He says, you know, there is no God but a God of lies. And he lives in exile for 15 years. And then he is resurrected, not supernaturally, but through the encounter of with a child and beginning to bring up a child. So she takes all the elements of the Christ story. She sort of strips them all the supernatural elements away from them, and she provides a secular, humanized, and humanistic account of what a 19th century Jesus would look like.
C.S. Lewis, then, respected lay theologian, but in something like The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, we get Aslan at the very centre of the narrative here. Now, Lewis always said, oh, no, there are no parallels here, I believe. But surely not. Surely the parallels are obvious to anybody.
Well, when he talked about Aslan, he insisted Aslan was not an allegory. I suppose that's the crucial thing. He said Aslan is not an allegory for Christ. Gotcha. Aslan is Christ. But he's Christ for Narnia. So if you live in Narnia, then your Christ is Aslan. If you live on Earth, your Christ is Jesus of Nazareth. And Aslan specifically says this to the children. He says, in your world, I have a different name. So there's a key point here is he's not saying that Aslan is not Christ, but he's not an allegory of Christ. He's what the Son of God would be like in Narnia. That's if you're in a world of talking animals and trees, this is what Christ would be like.
Well, let's have a listen to a clip from one of the film versions of the Lion, Witch and the Wardrobe series. This is The Voyage of the Dawn Treader. Aslan, voice of Liam Neeson here, and Lucy is played by Georgie Henley.
This is our last time here, isn't it?
Yes. You have grown up, my dear one. Just like Peter and Susan.
Will you visit us in our worlds?
I shall be watching you always. In your world, I have another name. You must learn to know me by it. That was the very reason you were brought to Narnia. That by knowing me here for a little, you may know me better there.
Will we meet again?
Yes, dear one. One day.
And that's the voice of Liam Neeson there as Aslan, Georgie Henley as Lucy in The Voyage of the Dawn Treader. And Jared Killeen is speaking to me this evening about Christ figures and Christ-like figures in literature and film through the ages. You know, just going back briefly to what you're saying there about C.S. Lewis, is it almost a tall, like he really is splitting hairs over, oh no, if you lived in Narnia, this would be Jesus. But if you live in the real, in the ordinary world, Jesus is the Jesus that you hear about in the Bible. Is he splitting hairs there?
I suppose one of the things, so we remember C.S. Lewis is one of the great popular theologians and evangelists, I suppose, really an apologist for Christianity in the 20th century. And one of the ways he's trying to evangelize is to present a very new approach to the old stories that we've all heard. I mean, one of his points was that you hear the name Jesus and he's a background noise. He's become so central to Western culture. So if you present him as a lion through a story for children. He becomes new. You kind of alienate the old version, and here you present this new, quite attractive, quite different idea of Jesus. Another thing, point is that, you know, this is not the meek, mild Jesus of that we encounter then in the 1960s. This is very much a frightening figure. If he inspires awe and terror. When the children encounter Mr. and Mrs. Beaver and they start talking about Aslan for the first time, Lucy keeps on saying, "Isn't he safe? Isn't he safe?" And Mrs. Beaver insists he is not safe. He is very dangerous. He is not a tame lion. Yeah. And you hear the roar then of Aslan at the end of that clip. Aslan is quite a frightening figure that you do not cross. He's not meek and mild.
Yeah, I suppose echoes of Blake's The Lion and The Lamb in some ways in that. But let's move on to another, a more recent manifestation, I think one could argue, of a Christ-like figure or a Christ figure, Superman.
Yes. Well, this is a controversial one. So Superman, of course, in 1938 is when he emerges.
Yeah, first appeared, yeah.
So he's written first by Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, who are both the children of Jewish immigrants. So, in a sense, he's clearly drawing on both Moses and Samson. I think they when they spoke about the religious origins of the Superman story, they did mention sort of the Hebrew Bible as the main source. But I think it's also self-evident when you think about the story of Superman. This is a man sent by his father to Earth, who's raised by parents who were originally called Joseph and Mary, originally supposed to be called Joseph and Mary, but they're human parents who raised this person who seems to be human but is actually of another species entirely, and his job is to save humankind from all, you know, from themselves essentially, and his father is Jor-El. And El is the Hebrew word for God. So I think it's, you know, I think it's so obvious that in many ways that they're drawing on the Christ story, even though they're also drawing on their Jewish background as well.
Yeah,
in the film versions, it's just all the filmmakers, Richard Donner, Zack Snyder more recently have been quite explicit in saying that they've drawn on Christian ideas and Christian mythology in order to make their version of Superman quite associated with ideas about dying, the dying Christ who comes to save the earth and then does usually die, certainly in Zack Snyder's version, and then is resurrected from the dead.
Well, you mentioned there that Jor-El means God the Father. Is that what you said it was in the Hebrew?
El certainly is the Hebrew word for God.
Well, the first words we'll hear in this, I think, are Kal-El, and that's Marlon Brando as the father of Superman addressing Kal-El, which I presume is probably son of God or something similar to that. Christopher Reeve is Kal-El, and this is from Superman 2 from 1980.
Look at me, Kal-El. Once before, when you were small, I died while giving you a chance for life. And now, even though it will exhaust the final energy left within me...
Father, no!
Look at me, Kal-El. The Kryptonian prophecy will be at last fulfilled. The son becomes the father. The father becomes the son. Farewell forever, Kal-El. Remember me, my son.
And that's Marlon Brando and Christopher Reeve there in a scene from Superman 2. Jarlath Killeen speaking to us about figures of Christ in literature and film this evening. And even as that clip ended, Jarlath, the music was like something straight out of a biblical epic, I thought. And at the very beginning of that scene, we find Christopher Reeve standing by himself, you know, shouting up into the heavens, Father, almost you're expecting, Father, Father, why have you forsaken me? You know, you're waiting for those words, or maybe echoes of Christ in the desert. The echoes are pretty obvious.
Oh, yeah, I think, and certainly in the film version, it's very, very clear. And at the end of that clip, you see Marlon Brando as the father merging with the son. Mm. So the father and the son becoming one. You know, it's all there. It's very difficult to avoid it when you look at the film version. And this has gotten, you know, the makers into some trouble because, yeah, it's a very, very controversial argument to make that Superman is Jesus in certain parts of America where you get, certainly in the Bible Belt, this is considered kind of sacrilege.
I want to finish up with Harry Potter, but maybe briefly you'd outline for me The Green Mile, the Stephen King novel, and obviously the subsequent film. The character of John Coffey, initials here quite useful, JC.
Oh, yes. So we have, yes. And what King is asking here is what would happen if Jesus came back? What would we do? Would we recognise him? Would we understand him? Would we accept him? And what his suggestion in The Green Mile is that if Jesus comes back, we'll just simply crucify him again. We'll kill him. Yeah. And so John Coffey in this novel is a healer. He's a miraculous healer. He's a gigantic African-American man who is arrested for the murder of a child, although what he was trying to do was actually bring the child back to life. But he has great healing power. When he heals someone, he lets a swarm of flies out of his mouth. At the end of this healing, it's clearly the Lord of the flies has been, you know, exorcised from the bodies of these crippled people. Mm. And what do? We imprison and then we execute Christ again. So King is quite clear in saying that
he thinks
that, you know, the earth is still not ready for Jesus to return.
And finally then, Harry Potter and J.K. Rowling, very straightforward, has acknowledged, yes, big intentional connection to Christianity, in fact, she says.
Absolutely. She said in an interview with Oprah Winfrey that there's a lot of Christian imagery in the books. Now, again, this is very controversial. I don't know if you know that the Harry Potter books are banned from many school libraries in certain parts of America and considered dangerous because of all the sorcery and the witchcraft within them. And here we have Rowling saying, you know, that there's a lot of Christianity, a Christian mythology being channeled. You think about Harry, we have a Christ figure. He needs to die in the final book. Great spoiler. He needs to die and then be resurrected in order to, you know, defeat the ultimate evil in the form of a serpent. You know, Voldemort, who looks like a serpent at this stage. The great serpent of the Garden of Eden, who is Satan. And of course, he also has this mark on his body, looks just like Christ, a kind of stigmata in the shape of the scar on his forehead.
Well, we'll finish up by leaving the final words. Jarlath Killeen there speaking to us about the figure of Christ in film and literature. And we'll finish up with a clip from Harry Potter. Harry Potter, played by Daniel Radcliffe, of course. Dumbledore is the other character in this clip, played by Michael Gambon.
Where would you say that we are?
Well, it looks like King's Cross Station, only cleaner and without all the trains.
King's Cross, is that right? This is, as they say, your party. I expect you now realize that you and Voldemort have been connected by something other than fate since that night in Godric's Hollow all those years ago.
So it's true then, sir. A part of him lives within me, doesn't it?
Did. It was just destroyed many moments ago by none other than Voldemort himself. You were the Horcrux he never meant to make, Harry.
I have to go back, haven't I?
Oh, that's up to you.
I have a choice.
Oh, yes. We're in King's Cross, you say. I think if you so desired, you'll be able to board a train.
And where would it take me?
On.
On indeed. The voice of Michael Gambon there and Daniel Radcliffe in a scene from Harry Potter. And before that you heard Jarlath Killeen speaking to us about the representations of Christ in literature and film. And just gone a quarter to eight on Monday night, Serena. The northern part of this island has produced many fine poets, it's fair to say. Few of them will have had the childhood of Sinead Morrissey, however, growing up in Belfast in the 1970s and 80s with communist parents, an experience she describes as the key to everything. Morrissey is an award-winning writer, six collections of poetry to her name. Hilary Mantel is a fan of her work. And now her publisher, Carcanet, has produced Found Architecture, a volume of Morrissey's selected poems. And Sinead is also Professor of Creative Writing of Newcastle University, Director of the Newcastle Centre for Literary Arts and Co-Director of the Newcastle Poetry Festival. And she joins me now on the line from Morpeth in Northumberland. First time I've ever had to say that word on air before. Morpeth. I don't even know exactly where it is. Where are you, Sinead?
I'm about 15 miles north of Newcastle.
All right. Okay. Now I know where it is. Now, the title here, Found Architecture, it takes its name, in fact, from a poem in your third collection, which was Through the Square Window from 2009, a poem that begins with the line, "These days are all about waiting." It's amazing how lines from poems take on new meanings, isn't it?
I know, everything changes in our current context. Yeah, that's a poem I wrote when I was pregnant with my first child, you know, and that's a very kind of weighted time, full of expectation. and here we all are. These days are all about waiting for our lockdown to end so we can all get back to our lives.
Is that the sign of a good poem? You know, a line that can have many different meanings at many different points in time and indeed for many different readers? Or is it pure luck when something like that happens?
I think it's inevitable that as context change, kind of meaning changes. I don't think meaning is necessarily a fixed thing in a poem, and it depends. Meaning is generated between a poem and a reader, like you say, and between a poem and its moment. So it is a kind of thing which is in flux. But also, I think a good measure of a poem is if you do want to reread it and if you can go back and find new things in it.
So that must have been exactly the process you've been involved with in the choosing of these selected poems for this volume called Found Architecture.
Yes.
1996 through until to 2017. Did you go back and read every single word that you had written and published?
Yes, I went back and sort of went through each collection. And then it wasn't very difficult because I had a clear sense of what were the strongest poems really in each of those books, or poems that I definitely wanted to include. And then my editor at Carcanet, Michael Schmidt, he was reading it all simultaneously. So I presented him with an initial list, and then he got back and said, I think you need to include these poems. And he was also the one who said, I really want you to include poems from your first book, because I'm not particularly enamoured of my first book, but he thought it would be fair to the trajectory that there was at least some representation from the early work.
Yeah, that first book, There Was Fire in Vancouver, back in 1996. Why the reference to Canada there?
Oh, there's a couple of poems that I wrote while I was a student in Canada in the summer, going door to door trying to sell Greenpeace membership.
You were quite the activist, actually, and a few of the poems that you've given us from that first collection show us that. There's a poem called CND, which has the line, "I want to grow up, not blow up." You were obviously very aware of the whole nuclear crisis at that time.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I was in a very politically active household. I was always brought to Communist Party meetings as a child. You know, I would stand with my parents while they sold copies of Unity on a Saturday in Cornmarket, and I was taken on, you know, CND marches and May Day marches. Mm. And there was a photograph of me, which I haven't seen, but I remember from the time that I literally did have a balloon that said, "I want to grow up, not blow up." And I was either 9 or 10. I was in my last year of primary school. And it featured on the cover of the Belfast Telegraph as part of a kind of big CND march in Belfast.
But there's a kind
so that's
there's
an inherent back to that moment.
Yeah, there's an inherent irony though there as well, isn't there, that you were referring to, you wanting to grow up and not blow up, at a time when, never mind the campaign for nuclear disarmament, growing up in Northern Ireland, unfortunately, and I don't mean to be glib here, blowing up was a big part of your childhood.
Yes, absolutely. And it was an irony of which I was completely unaware, I have to say. The irony of that statement in Belfast at that time. It was completely over my head. Did not see it. Did not connect the two things. My war was the Cold War, and everything else that was kind of going on around me in Northern Ireland felt very much alien to my understanding and at a remove.
Why do you think you were at a remove from the Troubles? It sounds astonishing, you know, at this point in time to be able to say that.
I think because I didn't feel connected to, I didn't really feel connected to either side. And I felt that my own heritage was kind of so mixed up and so contrary in a way to the kind of dominant discourses that, I was appalled by it. And, you know, it's not that I wasn't aware of the ongoing situation, but I didn't feel I had purchase on it, or I didn't feel, you know, I didn't feel allegiance really one way or the other. I just wanted it to stop. Whereas I did feel kind of passionate allegiance to Russia, really, during the Cold War, and America to me were the bad guys and Russia were the good guys, and everything had been misrepresented. And like so many people of my generation as well, terribly aware of the nuclear threat. That seemed to me to be more imminent and more terrifying than anything that was going on around me in the streets of Belfast.
You mentioned that Michael Schmidt insisted, this is the founder and MD of Carcanet Press, insisted that you go back to the earlier works and have a look at it. And I'm afraid I'm going to ask you to do the same thing this evening, but for a reason, because you talked about, and he talked to you about this idea of the trajectory of your career and of your writing. And the very first poem that we get in this selected poems, Found Architecture, maybe you just read that for me, first of all, and I can explain afterwards why I want the listeners to hear Among Communists.
Sure. Among communists. I remember smoke and faces that I knew and the fact that I got in free. My mother taking money by the half-collapsed sink. Posters proclaiming an evening of Brecht and subtitled, Bring Your Own Drink. Too much conviction to see through.
And that's Sinead Morrissey reading from her very first collection. In fact, there was Fire in Vancouver, published in 1996, and the poem Among Communists, which is the first poem that we get in her current volume, Found Architecture, which is her selected poems. And I get you to read that, Sinead, because that's telling the story of your communist, the household you grew up in, and how left-wing and socialist and communistic a family it was.
That's right. And there was they put on a kind of fundraising social when I was young, and it literally was that, an evening of Brecht, and they produced little posters, and it literally did say underneath, bring your own drink. And it was an evening of poems by Brecht, and then there was a performance of The Measures Taken, and my mother was one of the actors, and it was the real highlight of my childhood. I learned all the lines, and I was so kind of transfixed by the play, and just by the whole experience of kind of being exposed to poetry and drama, and this kind of sense of intellectual fervor and excitement. So that is actually all true, yeah. And I mean to look back on it, those aspects of it, with great affection.
And you then revisited, I think you said, is it like a reworking of that poem in your 2013 collection, Parallax, the one that won you the T.S. Eliot Prize, The Party Bazaar. So normally you would think the young poet, there'll be loads of words on the page and he or she will write, you know, forever in a day. But there you only give us seven lines. But then you revisit the theme in The Party Bazaar, a longer poem. Can we hear that now?
Yes, absolutely. The Party Bazaar. Ingrid in her shawls, been here since 9, burdening the tables on loan from the church downstairs with babushka dolls and caviar, handkerchiefs and wine from Yugoslavia, Bulgarian perfume. My brother and I ask for a job and are handed pink and white posters of peace and détente to decorate the room. It's trickier than we thought to stick them straight, so secretly we give up. Almost everyone's smoking. in the background, Kalinka on cassette, belted out by the Red Army Choir, wobbles towards its peak. There's tea, coffee, Irish stew, and a cool display of anti-Mrs. Thatcher paraphernalia, pens in the shape of nails for her coffin, we'll buy and use in school. Shop stewards come and sympathisers who, once a year, like Christians, demonstrate their faith. The odd, bewildered, lured-in shopper looking for soap or socks. But mostly, it's just us. Card carriers and the kids thereof filling up the air with fevered talk. By four, Rosemary Street's ablaze in the solstice dark. We pack what's left of the wooden trains and vodka into crates for another year and repair to the Duke of York, where once an actual Soviet representative, tall, thin, in frost-inflected English, gave a speech, and I clutched my lemonade and was convinced.
That's Sinead Morrissey reading her poem The Party Bazaar from her 2013 collection Parallax, but the poem is part of her current publication Found Architecture, her selected poems. It is interesting to see the level of detail that you go into, and I must say we get a much better flavour of the kind of the nature of the milieu that you grew up in the second poem, Sinead. Do you think that, you know, further into your writing life, was it easier to be more open, or what had changed, do you think, that you went a much more explicit route in some ways in The Party Bazaar?
Yeah, I think I just got more confidence at sustaining a poem, actually. So I think, you know, a lot of the poems you'll see from in the selection from the first collection, which starts Find Architecture, they're all really, really brief. You know, there are a few lines, and I obviously felt I could, you know, get in quick, say something short and get out again, just about. But, you know, through 25 years of working and, you know, on all the poems I wrote and, you know, learnt my craft, you know, through the process of writing, I just got more confident with detail, with description, with stanza, with line, with the kind of the momentum of a poem, with even humour. And there was so much in that world which was so idiosyncratic and unique to that moment that other people don't really know about, that I wanted to kind of pull some of that out and really tell the story through the detail.
And that's exactly what you did in The Party Bazaar. And of course, Parallax, as I said, was the publication that won you the T.S. Eliot Prize. That's Sinead Morrissey there speaking to us about Found Architecture, Selected Poems, which is published by Carcanet. Now, earlier today, President Michael D. Higgins led tributes to folk singer Mary McPartland, whose death was announced this morning. Mary McPartland was born in County Leitrim, became well known on the Galway folk scene of the 1970s, forming a musical duo called Calypso at that time. She then went on to tour with the Druid Theatre Company. Her first solo album, The Holland Handkerchief, came quite late in her life, when she was 50, in fact, but she was widely acclaimed in folk circles and beyond. That was in 2003. It was followed by albums Petticoat Loose in 2008 and From the Mountain to the Mountain in 2016. But sadly, it was today that we heard of the death of Mary McPartland, Er Yeshlov De Goroa Honam Yilish. And that is our lot for this evening here on Monday Night's Arena. Paula Shields was the researcher this evening. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Jamie Doyle was on sound. And tonight's programme was produced by Olin McGann. Talk to you tomorrow night at 7 once again.